So today on CamFM, I'm joined by Professor Simon Baron Cohen, who's a professor of developmental psychopathology at the University of Cambridge, and he's also the director of the university's Autism Research Centre. Thank you very much for joining me today.
Thank you for inviting me.
So you've just done a talk at the Cambridge Union linking the Rubik's Cube with lots of other topics. How did you find that?
Well, I mean, this was a first, I think, for us, and maybe internationally. What we were trying to do is make a connection between the Rubik's Cube, autism, and other disciplines like mathematics and art. So in some ways we were having to find the connections. In other ways we were quite happy to let the audience make their own connections. But actually, because we'd invited people from very different fields, some people with autism, some people from the world of mathematics, obviously Mr. Rubik himself, and also some musicians, it was really a chance to sort of see what they all share.
And I just wanted to talk a little bit about autism more specifically. And the first question is almost quite a basic one, perhaps, for someone like yourself, but maybe not for other people. And I just wondered if you could quickly go through the stages of autism diagnosis for anyone who doesn't know.
Yeah, so autism is diagnosed when someone has social difficulties, for example, making friends or keeping friends, communication difficulties, so for example, frequently misunderstanding what people might mean, or maybe being very delayed in their language development. But the other side of autism is that they have very strong interests in very narrow topics. This is sometimes called obsessions. And in the right environment, of course, being very obsessive about something can be very positive because it means you become an expert in something. So if you, for example, become obsessed with the piano, as Derek in our event today has done, you know, thousands and thousands of hours of repetition on the piano has turned him into an absolute prodigy. But sometimes these obsessions are less useful, shall we say. But it's when all those signs or behaviours are interfering with the person's ability to cope, that's when they might need a diagnosis.
Okay, thank you very much. And we were talking a little bit there about how autism can manifest itself. And from your opinion, would you say that the culture we live in today, that autism is misunderstood? I mean, for instance, the word autism or autistic can be used quite flippantly in discussion, and it can often be met with ignorance and naivety. So if you would say that autism is misunderstood in today's society, how could this be solved, in your opinion?
Right. I think there are misunderstandings about autism, and I think that society's reaction to people with autism isn't as good as it could be. So the first point to make is that autism is a disability, but it's only a disability in certain environments when the person is expected to be sociable and communicative. But if you sort of leave the person to their own devices and let them be, you know, if society has a tolerance towards people who might be less sociable or who might not enjoy socialising, but nevertheless just let them learn and process information in the way that they choose, sometimes individuals can really show remarkable talent. And a common sign in autism is excellent attention to detail, that people with autism might spot things that other people miss, and they may become fascinated by the detail of things. And that's, in a way, it links back to what we were saying about being obsessional, that whereas a typical child learning about, say, dinosaurs might learn the names of three or four dinosaurs, but they might move on to a new topic, whereas someone with autism may want to learn the names of every dinosaur that ever lived, where they lived, how heavy they were, what kind of teeth they had, what they ate, when they died out, etc. So they're collecting often a huge amount of encyclopedic detail or knowledge. And I think that's the kind of positive side of autism, that if we can, as a society, if we can make space for people who like to learn in depth rather than in breadth, then people with autism can find their place and make their contribution.
Okay, thank you. And moving on to more of the scientific side of autism, your research at the end of the day. I read something a while ago about the environmental factors alongside the genetic factors in the development of autism, and I was just wondering how important you felt that the environmental factors were in the development of autism.
Well, I think we know less about the environmental factors. We certainly know that autism involves genetic factors because autism runs in families. So if you've got one child with autism in the family, the chance of another brother or sister also having it is much higher than in the general population. So that's one clue that it's genetic. And the second clue is when you look at twins. If you look at, for example, identical twins where one has autism, the chance of the co-twin, the other twin also having it, again, is much higher than in the general population or even in non-identical twins. So those are kind of clues that it's genetic. But we know that autism isn't 100% genetic because you can have identical twins where one has autism and the other one doesn't. So there must be an environmental component. But we're not very good yet at identifying what the environmental factors are. We published a paper just 2 weeks ago looking at hormones prenatally, and that might be considered an environmental factor because these are hormones that the baby in the womb is exposed to. So it could be that one of the environmental factors is a hormonal one, and that interacts with the genetic predisposition. And the hormones we were particularly measuring were the so-called sex steroid hormones like testosterone, which are known to affect brain development. But in all honesty, I think we're right at the beginning of trying to understand the environmental component.
Okay, thank you. And you talked a little bit there about the genes in the womb and how they can develop in the womb. And from what I can understand, the ability to detect autism in babies that aren't born yet is getting better and better. Where do you stand on the ethical debate about if a parent knew that their child before they were born was going to be autistic? Where do you stand on that debate about the possibility of a termination or that they knew before?
Yeah, well, it is a really complex ethical question you're asking. We know that for other disabilities like Down syndrome, there are prenatal tests, and sometimes the way those tests are used is just to prepare for the fact that you may have a child with Down syndrome, so you can prepare, you can organise the right support. But you're right, that other parents use the test to make a decision about termination of the pregnancy. I don't think this is really relevant to autism yet, because there is no prenatal test. I think we're many years away from that. I mean, at the moment, research is identifying so-called biomarkers, biological differences that are associated with having a diagnosis. But none of those biomarkers are predictive yet of autism, so that they could be used in a prenatal test. But I think the other ethical issue that I think probably is behind your question is that because autism is not just a disability, it's also just a difference. The brain is developing differently. The person may be thinking differently. Why should we even be thinking about a test to prevent autism? It's not as if it's a disease that either the individual or society would be better off without. It's not a disease like cancer, for example. So I think I personally would be very concerned if there was a prenatal test for autism that was being used to help parents make a decision about termination. So, but there's certainly a need for the ethical debate to happen long before a test like that is available.
Thank you. I was reading a paper which you published a few years ago now, where you mentioned that mind blindness theory can prove useful when accounting for social and communication difficulties with autism. And then you mentioned another group of features such as repetitive behaviour, which we've already mentioned, narrow interest and attention to detail, which you believed could be understood with the empathising systemising theory. Could you just explain that theory a little bit for me?
Yeah, so because autism has these two different sides to it, on the one hand a social communication disability, but on the other hand a fascination with detail and very narrow interests and a love of repetition, I think probably we need two factors to, at least two factors to explain autism. So the empathizing, systemizing theory proposes that in autism, the individual has below average empathy, but particularly what's called cognitive empathy, or being able to imagine someone else's thoughts and feelings and to predict other people's behavior. So that's why they find the social world very confusing and often try and avoid socializing. But the other side is systemizing, that people with autism may have not just intact systemizing, but even very strong systemizing. So systemizing is all about being able to identify the rules in a system, whether it's a Rubik cube, or whether it's a mathematical problem, or whether it's a musical piece, or a machine like your computer, how the system works. You have to systemize to really analyze the rules, but then also use those rules to predict how the system is going to behave. And people with autism seem to be very attracted to systems of one kind or another. So these are the two different sides to autism. I think I just kind of add that some people misinterpret this theory as if it's saying that people with autism lack empathy. That's not really what the theory says, and I don't think it's really true, because there's another component to empathy. It's called affective empathy, which is all about caring about whether someone else is suffering, caring about how other people feel. And if you talk to people with autism, even if they have trouble reading another person, if they hear that person is suffering in some way, it bothers them, it upsets them, and they want to do something about it. So it suggests that actually people with autism do have affective empathy, even if they have trouble with cognitive empathy.
Thank you very much. And I think just to wrap up, I guess, looking forward, what would you see as the direction that research into autism needs to go into in the next few years, and also how people, I mean, we spoke a little bit earlier about how people can cope with autism, how the mechanisms that can be put in place. There's kind of two separate questions there. Where would you like the research to go in the next few years, and also where would you like the mechanisms for helping people with autism to go in the next few years?
So in terms of research, I guess you can divide it into basic research into causes and then applied research into what helps. And in terms of basic research, I think having the technology of brain scanning is great, but most of the brain scanning has been used with older people with autism. So we know a fair bit now about how the brain is different in people with autism, at least in adulthood or in adolescence, but we don't know so much about the early development of autism. So using MRI scanning, for example, with infants, or at the earliest point of diagnosis, so we can see what's different about the developing brain in autism, I think would be a really exciting future direction. But in terms of applied research, you know, what might help? First of all, I think, you know, we're waking up to the idea that autism is a very broad spectrum. In the event today, we had two people on different points of that autism spectrum, one with Asperger's syndrome, one with classic autism. Both of them had associated disabilities. So the man with Asperger's syndrome also had dyslexia, and the man with classic autism was also blind from birth. So in a way, what we need is research that can evaluate different interventions, different treatments, tailored to different people on that very broad spectrum. It's not going to be a one-size-fits-all. And so a lot of the kind of research that we need, that parents are desperately needing, is the evidence of what works and for whom.
Well, thank you very much, Professor Simon Baron-Cohen, for joining me this afternoon on CAMFM.
Thank you very much.